welcome to another series in the podcast, Mind the Gap, exploring the impact of racism on mental health of African people and their descendants living in Ireland. They are the visible migrants. We're not saying that other migrants are not having any racial discrimination, but we are focusing on the Africans living in Ireland having issues with racism and the impact on their mental health. So today we have a very special guest, a well-accomplished young lady with her family. She came here a while back. Her name is Joyce, and that's all I'm going to give you this time. I want to introduce Joyce to you, and I want you to just listen and hear her story, having been through the direct provision and what she experienced. Please give her all your attention and all your ears. Joyce, you're welcome to the program today. How are you?
I'm all right, Marian. How are you?
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. Joyce, I find this a real privilege, and I don't take it lightly. We know that it's not easy to come forward, but we are listening to you, and so will be a whole lot of others, as well as, we hope, government to understand how this works. Now, when did you come to Ireland, Joyce?
I came to Ireland 2006.
Wow. And what was the purpose of coming to Ireland? Could you share that with us, please?
Actually, coming to Ireland was, I was coming to join my spouse who was already here.
So did you come by yourself or with your children to join him?
I had only one then.
Right. So you came here to join your spouse. And was he an economic migrant, an asylum seeker, or what was he at that point in time?
He was an asylum seeker. He was an asylum seeker then.
So you had, was that a reunification to come and join him? You had that permission to come and join him?
Not yet. He had not yet gone to that part. He was still an asylum seeker in the hostel. So when I came to join him in the hostel.
Right. Okay. So you came to join your spouse with one child in the hostel. And can we ask you, how did you find that period?
Well, then it was a little bit scary. It was a little bit scary, obviously, leaving home and coming to a foreign land. It was a little bit scary. But having him then, it was okay because I had a bit of support, you know.
And so you came from far, was South Africa, East Africa, West Africa, which part of Africa?
Southern Africa, and him is from East Africa.
Right, okay. But you came to join and you had your child. And where you came to live with him, was it in a direct provision situation that you came to join him?
It was accommodation. In the direct provision, yeah.
And what was the situation, having now you're a family, you're here, you're seeking asylum with your husband? How was the process for you and your family?
Well, it became difficult because then our relationship became a bit strained, you know, living in the hostel, living in that one room and not knowing what the future hold for us. So unfortunately, a relationship ended because it was difficult for both of us, and we found our ways. We actually got our divorce here in Ireland.
Now that is, I'm really sorry to hear that. But you mentioned a couple of things that I would like the listeners to just home on. Living in that one room with your child and your husband seeking asylum in Ireland, what was the impact of living in that one room, not knowing what to do? What was the situation that you could explain to us that impacted your marriage?
Well, it was just the whole living situation, you know, living with the different types of people, not being able to really express yourself as who you are, holding back who you are because you always want to go out there and show that you are happy, you are content, you are okay, while in fact you are not really happy. Just living around very close, because living in the hostel like that, we are close to other people. There's no, you don't have really privacy, you know. And with the spouse and all that, it was just another situation. It was the toughest experience.
What were you able to
in
work?
Terms of finance, in terms of then we are not allowed to work. Then we are not allowed to work. So we're always together, always in each other's vicinity, you know.
Were you given any financial support for the child and for yourself and your husband?
We appreciated then, of course, because we didn't have any other avenue of income, you know, but it was not enough. And I think that is one of the things that was also impacting in marriage, because you don't have any social life. You don't have any other thing to come when that little supplementary income come. You just finishes on the most basic toiletries, you know, and the demands for a child for school. And that's it.
Oh my gosh. How old was your little girl, or was your little boy? How old was your little child then?
She was six then.
So, and what about the impact on her having that situation in the tiny room, nowhere to play?
It was difficult for her. It was very difficult for her. We were sleeping with her, and she never had any friends coming over to visit her. She never had any friend even inviting them to come to their house. She never had a proper social life, like, and she just go to school, come back to the house, go to the park, and go into queue for the food downstairs, not having the kitchen to cook. And it really had a very huge impact on her, because growing up, that age of six is the age that girls like to explore. They like to bake, they like to have sleepovers, they like to, you know, go out with their friends or invite them over for play dates and all, but she never had those kind of things.
And you can see, did she become withdrawal, or how was her behavior?
I think when I look back now to who she is now, she have become, I can say she is, which word can I use? She is very angry towards me. She is very angry towards me, and she is the child that I think I need help for more than all of us, because as we are adults, we know how to maneuver these kind of things, even though it's difficult. But having her, seeing her going through what she's going through now because of that experience, it is the difficultest situation I never experienced. And I never really thought it would be like that, you know, because I think now she's growing her, and now that is the one that was born there. But the eldest also, she's still having kind of, you know, social anxiety and all those kind of things, you know, because there's a lot of things that we missed, we didn't have. And it's like having spent 12 years in the hostel, it have really made us miss a lot in a way that it's now that they are trying to kind of catch up, and it is difficult that their friends are in a certain level and they are still in the certain, and they are wondering why, you know. Why in college, in secondary school, is like difficult thing for them, and it is just the experiences that we have from the hostel, just living the way we live, because the ages that were there, it is the age that they could have really experienced some other kind of life that they never had.
Do you know what, Joyce, I thought I heard you say, I'm just going to confirm, because I think the listeners would be quite alert. You said you spent 12 years in a direct provision center with the children. So by now, how
yes.
many children did you have? That they were all here in that same one room?
I came with one. She was six when we came. And then I got the other one who was born there and literally just left there when she was 11 or 10. You know, so she basically just grew up in there. And then I left with the last born. Now she is five. She left when she was two. Thank God for her. She's the happiest girl.
Now, isn't that strange? You had three children altogether. One, you came, and then two, I just want to explain for the listeners so they could hear the situation. For 12 years, you're in this direct provision center, which you said you were grateful for being able to be there, but no chance to work. Very claustrophobic. The children had no way to play. And your first child who came in, obviously, with all the impact of both parents trying to get papers, played out on her. She says she's the one that has suffered the most. And the youngest one, because she left when she was just 2 years, by that time you had got your papers and got things sorted out. You are a bona fide Irish citizen. And she was only in the direct provision for 2 years. You say she's the happiest child
compared to her sisters. She is my best friend. She doesn't have any remorse against me. She is like, but the big girls, I'm trying by all means every single time. They still have that thing within them. They still have that thing. And I'm really so scared for them because I don't know what their future holds between me and their relationship, you know, because they are remorseful against me about the whole situation.
Right.
Unfortunately. Because, and it is the saddest thing to see because they are the sweetest kids that I feel I have robbed them of their childhood. Because, and the reason why I am certain and I know that is this situation is because they speak about it when they are angry. They say it out when they are angry.
Now, I'm really sorry to hear that. So, having come to Ireland to seek asylum, to seek refuge, another place, instead you find that you were divorced, children who were very angry and embittered because of how they've had to live their life. They were isolated from friends, the triggers, they were nodded, they were... Did they suffer discrimination in their schools or anything like that? Did they ever say about racial discrimination?
No, not at all. Not at all. But obviously, I wouldn't say discriminations because I think that, you know, social life, everyone around you look who they feel fit to befriend, you know, but for them, they could feel it if they are not invited to birthday parties and they know that my friend is having a birthday and she's distributing birthday cards, inviting some of our friends, and I'm never invited to any of those because everyone knew that I don't have a house, I live in the hostel, you know, and you also, you know, your birthdays, you cannot invite anyone because you don't have where to invite them to.
That's a childhood trauma there and then, isn't it? That's what you're saying.
No, but
definitely.
Huge. It have impact because now the thing is, I know that probably even me, the impact that the direct provision had in me going through divorce when I'm in the hostel and going through the uncertainty of my future, it have had really because my social life was very bad. Up to now, it is still very bad. And I think it have caused my kids also to start wondering why my life also is like this, because they don't really see me with anyone. They don't see anyone coming over. They don't see me saying, let's go to someone. And it is that thing that, you know, if it could have been built in relationship, probably it could have been then, you know, with the people that we're living with. But it was just very difficult because I had a lot. And I wish they could understand that, you know, it's not that mommy kind of neglected them or somehow. I was also going through a lot. And you are going through this lot, you don't really have access to support, you don't know where to go, and you are also scared to look for support to tell the truth, because you are scared that, okay, I might look for help and all this, and people, they'll start thinking that I'm not fit to take care of my kids, you know? So you become scared and you just close yourself and you don't get help at all. So when I look back, I can see that the whole process and the whole years that
the 12 years she spent,
they have really had impact on me as the mother. That have really transferred to my kids. Now I can see it. Unfortunately, I could not see it before because maybe they were not talking about it. But now looking at my daughter who's 14 now and the 21-year-old now, they are talking about this experience. I now certain that, oh my goodness, that have really had an impact. You know, but for me, I'm to see if I can get proper life future for you guys. And I want you to see it in this way. You know, but at the same time, there are kids who don't deserve to know how or why I'm failing. They just want the best, just like any other child. And it is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking.
And do you know what? One of the things you said, I'm really It's really breaking my heart just to hear the degree to which young people who live in direct provision centre can be suffering like this, and we may not even know about it because the parents are the ones that concentrated are trying to get their papers and all the rest of it, and this is going on. And you know, just simple thing like going to a party and they're not invited, and when the invitations are going out, you can't go, and you too cannot invite other people. I think that's a tragic, that is a loss of childhood. Have you been able to get any help for them? Do they have any? Was there any professional counseling that came through?
I have tried, but my goodness, it's too expensive. I cannot afford. But my wish is, if I could get help, I would take my kids to get the help that they need, because I know they need it, and I don't want them to grow with this in their heart, because I address it as soon as possible, as soon as possible.
Right.
But it's very expensive, you know. Yeah, it's very expensive.
So you are not offered anything while you were in direct provision center for counseling? You didn't get any opportunity to get to the doctors to say, this is what's happening? What was the fear?
Well, that was the fear that I had, because we already knew that the impact that also, you know, how some of the, yeah, because you are careful of what you kind of help you are seeking from people. You never know who you are asking help from. You never know who might take your request for help as a sign of weakness as a mother.
Right.
And then your story changes and you find yourself being pulled around by social workers. So that is why I'm saying that fear of asking for help, because you never know who is who around you. You know, the people you're opening up to, they are the same people that can really destroy your life at the same time. So you just try to deal with these things. We just try to deal with these things by yourself, you know?
Yes, I understand fully, because you don't want your children to be taken away from you. You don't want to feel that you're less
then
of a mother.
You begin to be judged, because I remember very well, I spoke to one lady and she was like, okay, when I was going through divorce, actually, I was going through divorce and I was talking to my caseworker, you know, and she was kind of, I knew she's like one of the people that I was close to then. And she tried by all means to give me her extra time apart from her, that because she could see that I'm going through a lot. And she was also trying to kind of, when I'm talking to her about some things, and she will be like, mind you, don't talk like that in the court, because the judge will think that you are not able to take care of the kids. You know, so those kind of things always made me to be kind of, oh my goodness, what then can I say? So a lot of things I even have to keep to myself, because I was scared to say things, not knowing who will. Because when I say that the difficulty of taking care of kids, if the judge here is saying it's difficult, they might think that you are not able to supply for these kids, and they might take them from you and give them to someone who is able to. You know, those kind of things. So it has been difficult in that manner that I was aware that now that, okay, you know, it's not that anyone you are coming to seek for help, they might really. Some people, they will not, they are just only kind of seeing how they can, you are talking to them, then so that they can know now have another avenue of helping you, which will not be help, because no one wants their kids to be taken care of because they are having difficulty in one area of their lives that can be rectified, you know.
That is really a real tragedy that you've just spoken on then, that people had fear, relevant fear, although you were suffering and you were impacted by these traumas of living in that place and the divorce, which we know anybody that goes through a divorce, we know that separation, the anxiety for you and for the children, yet there was no real help. And when you finally left the provision center 12 years after that, did you have any housing problem? Were you able to quickly get your housing?
No. Lucky enough, I didn't stay long after having got my leave to remain. I didn't stay long. I got a house very quickly, thank God. So we moved out quickly. But then moving out quickly, you know, it is another thing, because mind you, that is the place that I'm used to. That is the life that I'm used to. That is my, you know, the only thing. So moving out from there, coming to this place, I think I was kind of sick. I don't know the kind of sickness I can even say, like I was sick or I was just kind of, you know, having to start this new life, not knowing where to begin, where to go, all those kind of things. But again, it was a good thing. I knew that it is a good thing that I'm out of there.
So it's like jumping from frying pan into fire. That's what we would say back in Africa. You jump from frying pan, you're no longer in direct provision. You've got the essential paper, which is to go out and you could work, you could do all this. But now how to asset, you got the housing, which is what people will say. Yeah, well, she's okay. She's got a Irish citizenship. She's got the housing. Yeah. But there's another trauma now. So how are you going to what was the other trauma now?
Yeah, that is it, because just from getting that document, that approval of your leave, my leave to remain, I became sick. The same day I received it, I read it, I became so sick for like 1 week. I couldn't move, I couldn't eat, I couldn't do anything. I was just lying on my bed like a vegetable. That was one thing, because people, they expect you to be happy. They expect you to say, "Ooh, my goodness, eh." But for me, that was another situation again. I became so sick, you know, not eating, not doing anything. Just there. Thank God for the friend that I had. They were helping me with the kids. But I was just there and I was just now starting to pray and asking God, please, God, don't take my life, because I didn't know what is happening. I didn't understand what is happening. I was not happy. I was not sad. It was like God was now taking me away from this world, because the way I felt was just out of ordinary, out of ordinary. And then moving out of that place, coming into this, my house here where I live, also it was another anxiety and everything, you know. Where do you start? It's a new town. I don't know anyone in here. I'm starting afresh. Thank God it was during the summer holiday, so we had long time to be home and get used to the area, you know,
I am so sorry for all this, but if you had just a minute or two to advise the government, because I'm glad that also hopefully we'll be able to put you through to those who can actually help your young ladies. If you had any advice to give to the government, what would you say to the government for this tragedy of 12 years in the Direct Provision Centre? What would you say to the government?
We've got to put an end now. What I would say is this, like, I know they are doing their best. That is the best they can do for people. That is the only best they know they can do for people. But people have health that is in conjunction with whatever is going on around them. You know, and I think that health is one of the major things that should be looked up after more than any other thing. The supply of services that are called to the need of asylum seekers is most important, especially the children. Their social life should not be forgotten. Like, services should be more available. They should at least even have services that comes to people in the asylum hostels, you know, because that is where the real problem is. And then for asylum seekers to go out there to seek for services, it's a struggle also for them to go out there. But if services could come to them one way or the other, you know, I know they need to integrate, they need to get into the society and all that, but it does not always work like that. Organizations should step up and work properly with asylum seekers, because I know, like, there is Jesuit Refugee Council, there is Irish Refugee Council, there is all those ones, they are there. And to me, I feel like they are just names, and I feel like they are spending more, but they are doing less.
We have to come to an end of this. You've given us some wonderful insight, and I think we're going to look at those organizations later on. Thank you so much, Joyce, for coming through. We really appreciate you, and because part of this program is that we'll also connect people together, so we'll connect you with those experts that have come on this program that will be able to offer those services to you, hopefully free of charge or resourced one way or the other. We want to thank you for coming to this podcast. Appreciate you, Joyce. Thank you very much. My sincere thanks and gratitude to Joyce for the boldness to come onto this platform to tell her story. I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking the time to listen to this podcast. Join me next time when my special guest will be Elizabeth Zion, writer and poet.
This is Near FM
90.3.